You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, August 18th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is a three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you got it. Still on vacation. Come on, I earned it. Plus, Matt had scheduled this a long time ago, and he's in Disney World. And Michael...
I am.
He's in Disney World. God knows what's happening with him right now. But Michael, the idea of Michael running the board, just that amount of stress. I mean, look, I did two shows for 6 weeks over the summer. Give me a break. What's that? But are we going to get new content? Oh, yes, you are. That's
definitely
right.
On.
My interview with John Nichols from Netroots Nation about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Sat down with John for about, I don't know, 20, 25 minutes, I think it was. And then from members, deep, deep archives. You'll recall back in the day, back in 04, I think it was, Janine Garofalo and I would sometimes get a call from Saddam Hussein. His accent would change every time he would call. It was really Fred Armisen. Don't tell anybody. And an interview that Janine and I did, I think it was the first interview we ever did, in fact, with Rick Perlstein back in 2004 when he was writing for the Village Voice. And I just thought it would be interesting. I enjoyed talking to him so much last week. It was actually, as I say that, it's this week. But as you hear it, it was last week. I don't know why I'm making such a big deal about this time shifting. Everybody, the vast majority of people listen to a podcast anyways. But I don't know.
No one's going to notice.
No one's going to notice except for the fact that I point it out all the time. Look at me. I'm going crazy. I've been on vacation for now almost 6-7 days. I'm losing my mind here. Actually, I haven't been on vacation for that long. I'm projecting forward. But then, look at me. I'm getting caught back up in this. All right. Enjoy this interview with John Nichols. Members, enjoy Saddam Hussein and Rick Perlstein. Tomorrow, members will hear from another Deep Archive show from 2004. Mark Danner talking about the torture that we were then becoming aware of. Obviously still in the news because of the CIA, the Senate Intelligence Torture Report, 10 years later, still being redacted. That's a conversation between Janine Garofalo, Lewis Lapham, and Mark Danner. And we'll be back live on Wednesday. So here's John Nichols.
Okay.
Continuing our coverage of Netroots Nation 2014 in Detroit, Michigan, it is a pleasure to welcome John Nichols from the Nation magazine, editor of the
Capital Times.
The Capital Times.
I work there. Yeah.
In Madison.
Yeah.
So, John, my understanding is that you are working on creating some type of plan, a jobs plan, with Representative Keith Ellison that can be implemented through executive action, because mm-hmm. I think at this mm-hmm. point it's rather settled mm-hmm. that we cannot rely on the Republican-dominated House to pass anything that the president proposes.
It's hard to even get things through the Senate. And so I would not begin to take credit for anything. Congressman Ellison and some union allies and some workers for federal contractors have been working very, very hard on getting, you know, deep into the weeds, into the specifics of how we make sure that federal contractors, A, pay their workers a fair and decent salary, give them decent benefits, but also how we make sure that they build out a workforce, that jobs that are needed are created. Because, you know, we keep talking about infrastructure. We keep talking about, creating jobs that need to be created, doing jobs that need to be done. And yet we see so many places where it's not quite happening. Right, we're contracting out. We're giving a lot of money, but we're not seeing things fully developed. Representative Ellison and other folks are starting to look at how can we do that. And one important thing to add to this, Sam, is I think that there are some of our very good Republican friends who might say, "Oh my gosh, executive orders on federal contracting—that's some sort of new radical idea."
Right.
It is important to understand that Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, Democrats and Republicans, repeatedly used presidential executive orders to alter and expand and extend protections with federal contractors.
Right. I mean, this is the least controversial aspect of this as to whether or not the president has authority in the context of federal contractors. Mm-hmm. I think, at the very least, evidenced by the fact that in Boehner's lawsuit, they spent a lot of time. They would have sued him for whatever he could have, and they couldn't even find an argument, really. So what are the type of things that can be done? I mean, there's some talk of a federal ENDA, which we've mm-hmm. already seen. Mm-hmm. On some level, the question is, you know, what's going to be the religious exemption? We can get into that. It's become a far more complicated question, in particularly after Hobby Lobby. Mm-hmm. But what are some of the things that the president could do? Because we should also remind people that the federal government, through federal contracting, is the largest low-wage employer in the country.
Exactly. And that's what Congressman Ellison and others are concerned about, many union folks as well. It is that we have a lot of employment there, but it isn't always well-defined, and it isn't always defined toward creating secure, well-paid, decent benefits, longer-term jobs, something that is actually, you know, that you get this job and you know you're going to be going to it tomorrow and the next day. And it's just giving some definition there to a place where the federal government pours immense amounts of money in. And I would make this case that many of our conservative friends who might initially say, "Oh, my gosh, I don't want the president doing anything there," if they think about it, might come to the conclusion that Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, and others did, that getting into this and giving it definition, giving it frame, is useful because it's a way to say, when we pour these federal dollars into all sorts of contractors, what do we get for it? How many jobs do we really get? And are those jobs good jobs that pay people a decent wage and make sure that we get people actually up to skill, maybe trained, so that we get the benefit that we had with the Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s. In the 1930s, young unemployed men, usually men, went to work in the Civilian Conservation Corps. They went out to camps, they built things and stuff like that. And at the time, there were critics who said, "Oh, this is just useless work." In fact, those people who went out and did those jobs actually after they went and beat fascism in World War II, came back and formed, in many cases, the underpinnings of the building trades. These are people who learned great skills in public employment, and they were able to go out and do all sorts of other things.
Let me tease this out a little bit and try and avoid arguing about whether or not our conservative friends are going to see the value in that. But hope springs eternal. But basically, what you're saying is that when we spend a dollar with a federal contractor, we obviously get the obvious result of that dollar. We're going to hire you to build a bridge.
Well, we hope we get the obvious result of that dollar.
But what you're also talking about is the subsidiary benefits that you get out of that dollar, in that you're going to employ someone to build a bridge, and they're going to go out and they're going to spend that dollar. But also, you may need to impart some technical knowledge on these people, and so you're going to train them. This also becomes a jobs training program.
An apprenticeship program, even.
And there's probably one or two other benefits that are embedded in that. And so you're saying that if we can structure, we can get a better sense both from a data perspective on what we're getting in return for that dollar. We can then more smartly target those dollars in a way that we get that. It's not technically a multiplier effect, but it is, I guess, in terms of social capital, it's a multiplier.
And let me take it one step further. You might, over time, get something that, again, many, many folks who aren't considered progressives talk about, which is public-private partnerships. You might actually get these contractors who are getting a great deal. I mean, we're talking immense amounts of money, getting a great deal of federal taxpayer dollars to make some long-term commitments as regards the diversity of their employment. Now, that goes back to Roosevelt, Eisenhower. Right. You know, and remember that affirmative action in federal employment has roots going back 50 years. So these are things we're talking about here, treating people fairly, bringing people into employment. But then if you link that to apprenticeship programs, if you link that to training as well as simply doing the job, what you do is you get a host of benefits out of it. And you also may make contractors better, so that they actually, a case can be made to have them do more work. And if that is the case, then we then begin to extend quality employment in a long-term framework, not doing the same job, maybe contractually going again and again. But remember that many of these contractors, they're permanent. I mean, the government continually has these relationships.
Right.
And yet the government does very little to define those relationships so that in a period of underemployment, of, in some cases, deep unemployment, we might use our federal contracting as a way to address much broader and deeper societal challenges.
I mean, in many respects, the analogy, I mean, it's actually, I think, a perfect analogy that Walmart has such massive buying power that it will tell its suppliers, it will fundamentally shape what its suppliers are doing. Not always, and I would argue maybe even very rarely, to the benefit of the suppliers or to the benefit of society as a whole.
Yeah.
But that power exists, and you can use that power also for things that would be positive.
And why wouldn't we? Look, I'm on the left. There's no mystery there. But I am saying this is a mainstream argument for every American.
It's being rational. It's getting the most benefit out of every dollar that you can.
And if our tax dollars are going to go do things, why don't we have them do things that are highly beneficial? And I got into this issue writing a biography years ago, almost a decade ago, of Dick Cheney. And I had a chapter on his efforts to privatize the military. And one of the things that fascinated me was when we, in the early 1990s, when we moved immense amounts of what we used to do in the military to the private sector, a fascinating thing happened. The pay for the same job went way up in the private sector. We pay the private sector to have people go into war zones and do things that soldiers used to do for, in some cases, a shamefully low amount of pay,
right?
At incredibly high pay. And that's, when I started to think about that, I thought, okay, you know, I'm not a fan of the amount of contracting out we have as regards to the Department of Defense. I think we way overdo it.
It's very problematic.
It's very problematic for
a host of reasons. But the dynamics,
if we're doing it, then we shouldn't just write a check and say, hey, here's a whole bunch of money. Go do what you want to do with it. Just, you know, show us some results 5 years from now. We ought to say, here's a whole bunch of money. And again, I'm talking more in the private sector domestically. Here is this whole bunch of money. Here are some of the things that we would hope, seriously, and we might want to do a little bit of accountability to see come back.
Right. Well, I mean, the idea of we're going to be a volume buyer of whatever it is you're offering, and it's going to come with certain conditions, is not exactly a
not some radical idea.
Right. This is just physics. I mean, I think, you know, I don't share necessarily your optimism that our conservative friends will see the benefits of that, because that presupposes a certain level of rationality in their political positions. Based on those rationality, I should say, that doesn't consider political considerations. But be that as it may, I am certainly respectful of you for having such optimism.
Well, let me suggest that, Sam Cedar, I always argue that optimism is the intellectual way out, because pessimism is, of course, the easy way to say nothing's going to work.
Yes.
I know you know that. In this instance,
the bottom line is the president has the authority.
Yes.
And there is absolutely no rational reason not to do this. I think we live in an era where there is political costs. In terms of those calculations, is basically flatlined in terms of where...
No matter what he does, he's going to be accused of doing the wrong thing. But what I'm saying, and I think what other folks are saying, and some of the unions and others are saying, is, look, if you're going to take those political costs anyway, why not rationalize this thing in a way that really does assure that the taxpayers are protected?
Right.
And I know that sounds like we've just flipped over to conservative talk radio or something like that, but no... Progressives ought to make that a part of our agenda. We ought to say, you know, if we aren't going to do something in the commons, in the public sector, with our public dollars, with public employees, which I happen to be a big fan of, and I think public employees happen to do a great job, but if we're going to contract out, as we do so much, let us establish a set of standards, and let us make sure that discrimination is not a part of that zone. Let us make sure that training and improvement in skills is a part of that. And let us make sure that a contractor who really does get it, who buys into it, that then we can actually think of longer-term ways to make stuff work.
It's rewarded. All right, let's take a quick fake break right here. And we'll come back. So, John, let's turn the conversation a little bit, because there's obviously been, and we've spoken about this, but I wanted to sort of see if we can broaden out the conversation a little bit. Unions have obviously been under attack systematically for 30-some-odd years. We're now seeing the Supreme Court get particularly aggressive.
Yes.
And Harris v. Quinn turned out to be... not as damaging as many anticipated that it could be. And Harris v. Quinn, of course, is this case where you had home health care workers. The SEIU had come in after there was this broad institutionalization, unionized these folks, and made a deal with the state of Illinois, which ended up raising their pay by a not insignificant amount.
A lot.
I think it's 20 or 30% at least, professionalized them. The court came in and was specifically talking about the fair share fees. These are the fees that basically you pay. If you don't want to join the union, that's fine, but you still got to pay them for negotiating on your behalf. It's a less amount, obviously, than dues, but it's called the fair share. This was struck down in the Supreme Court, but only on the grounds that there was not for these people, because they did not qualify as actual public employees. In that case, Sam Alito signaled that he wants to attack the original precedent, this Abood precedent from 1977, Abood v. Detroit, which basically says we're going to invalidate the concept of fair share. That's what he wants to do. It's unclear whether or not he'll be able to get there in the next case, but I don't know that I would ever bet against these guys to get to where they want to get. It's just a matter of time. So with that said, John... What next for unions. Let's assume we're in a post-Abood world. We're seeing a couple of different things happen in the union movement right now, it seems to me. One is sort of a social justice model of unionism, which is coming out of sort of where the teachers were seeing this. At that Charlotte plant, or in Chattanooga, I guess, we're seeing a different non-official union, sort of just like a group of workers getting together that they're hoping the management will recognize them as the sole bargaining power without outside of the union system. And we're also seeing sort of alt-union groups around low-wage workers. I mean, give me your sense. You've been immersed in this world for...
A long time.
A long time.
Yeah. Look, this is the complex reality of the moment we are in. The trade union movement is under assault from almost every corner of the right, but also, frankly, a lot of the corporate sector. And it is important to say... Many mainstream political forces and economic forces, there are even some Democrats who are quite problematic on this issue. And where it ends up is this. Unions are getting hit from all sides. They're largely being hit not for economic reasons, but because they are political forces. And they defend the commons. Public sector unions especially defend public education, public services, at a point where the constituencies for these things are not organized otherwise, or not well organized. And so... you end up with Republican politicians, frankly, who figure out if we can just disempower the unions, we get rid of fair share, we get rid of all these other things, make it complicated for unions to engage politically, they are going to be rendered no problem to us. That is then going to allow for more privatization, more to do all the things they want to do. So what do unions have to do at this point? I think you have to study your opposition. You got to look at who's trying to shut you down and why, okay? And if that is the case, then unions have got to build mass movements. And unions have got to start to talk about what they do to the people that they do these things for and get them engaged in a big, big way. There's a movement in public education that's quite fascinating. I've actually seen the shift of the education debate. It kind of blows my mind. Some of it driven by testing issues, quite frankly, that teachers care about but also parents care about. But we are starting to see in cities across this country mass coalitions of educators and parents.
Right.
And when the Chicago teachers went on strike in 2012, everybody outside Chicago said, oh, they're doomed. They're going to get whooped. Right? But in Chicago, fascinating thing happened. They started polling, started finding parents back to teachers because the teachers had spent 2 years going out to parents and talking to them. I hate to tell my friends in the trade union movement that they have a lot of work ahead of them, but that's a simple reality. They have to build a mass constituency for what you do. And you do that for two reasons. Number one, you do that to have something real, have a support for you when you're under assault. But two, you do that because if you want your members to pay their dues, right, to engage, you need their family, you need their friends to say that's a good thing too. And you know what I mean? It has to extend out. It can't just be an individual choice for somebody saying, you know, boy, it's hard to pay my bills. And if I don't pay my dues, I mean, I like my union. I don't. And that's the problem. You know, it's not like when you get rid of fair share, when you get rid of dues checkoff, which is what a huge goal. It isn't that people stop paying their fair share or stop paying their dues because they don't like the union. Huge number of them like the union, but they're hard pressed. Right. They got a lot of other demands on them.
Right.
And you know as well as I, if something doesn't come out of it.
If you're going to get something for free, a lot of people are in a position not to make that sort of calculation that I'm going to pay for it.
It's like getting in your backseat of the car. Do you say, yeah, I'll throw in for gas?
Right.
Right? And so this sort of community organizing that goes way beyond the traditional model, and it's actually something we've learned, intriguingly enough, from voter registration. There's a friend of mine who was doing voter registration among Latinos, and he'd been working on it, and they said, well, you know, a lot of people are new immigrants. Not everybody's got, you know, all their paperwork in order. And for years they'd say, you'd ask them, do you have your paperwork in order? Like, because I don't want to talk to you if you don't. I'm going to just talk to you if you do. And then this guy, some years ago, he figured out, he said, no, I'm going to talk to everybody. Because if you're somebody's sister, if you're somebody's daughter, if you're somebody's mom, and maybe, you know, you're in the process of getting citizenship, or maybe, you know, whatever's going on, if you tell the members of your family who are in,
right,
and you know what?
Well, they become surrogates on some level, right?
They massively increased turnout in the areas they were working.
Interesting.
And so unions are going to have to do this. And I wish, Sam, that I could give you some sort of like, well, there's a bill, or there's a legal strategy, or there's something.
Well, this is
this is core organizing.
This is about almost like interior union reform, right?
I mean, this is
and you know. This dynamic between the sort of, I guess they call it the business union model and the social justice union model, which is sort of the Chicago school. I interviewed the other day Barbara Mataloni from Massachusetts. She is it was really exciting.
And she's on this page.
Very much so. And they're talking about education as being at the forefront of sort of a fighting the neoliberal project and about reaching out to the community. And she was her win was certainly not something that anyone from the outside would have predicted. Similar dynamic to the way that an upstart caucus within the union sort of spread out their message. And so and it's interesting. I mean, teachers seems to be the most obvious place to do something like that because you have a direct relationship with the community.
And we love teachers.
Right.
You know, the weird thing is teachers poll very well.
You've got 30 members of the community, maybe 60, you know, assuming on how many kids have two parents who want to talk to you more often than not as a teacher.
And also, you know, the weird thing about it is small businesses, teachers buy a lot of products. They're engaged with the community. You know, you can't imagine when you start to think about this in the right way, how much of our community is related to the school. And when we start to build that out, we do big things. There's a reason why the right focuses so much energy, so much money on education, because they know that's a central building block for a whole bunch of other things. All I would suggest to you is this: this pride in trade unionship, the sense of being a member of a union is something to be proud of. You pay your dues because you want to do it, because you believe in it. That is something that's got to be built up. I have seen it happen, intriguingly enough, in some places where unions have been very much under assault. And there's a historical example on this. During the Red Scare, some unions were really brutally targeted. There was a real effort to destroy them. One of the unions was United Electrical. They represented a lot of big electronics plants in the East Coast. They were targeted for destruction. They were raided by other unions. They were undermined by the NLRB. But you know what the interesting thing was? They had such pride in their union. They really did. They were pioneers in union education, why we do this, who we are. The interesting thing is the United Electrical Union exists to this day. They survived an assault as immense and as intense as anything you'll see now. And what I would suggest to you is pride in trade unionism, not apology, but a sense this is an important part of our community that returns real wages to our community, that protects people, that builds things that matter. That education process may be more important than any legislative strategy or even a legal strategy.
When you look back on what took place in Madison, and you were obviously out there,
I was sure there
every day. I came out for, I think it was the last weekend when the farmers came to town, and I think you were obviously speaking in front of those folks quite a bit. As you look back on that difference between an electoral strategy and sort of building out a popular support within the community, do you think that there was a tactical or strategic mistake that was made there? I mean,
actually, in hindsight, it's very easy to say.
Well, yes,
you have 150,000 people
right
at a rally on a Saturday, that maybe you might want to say on Monday we're going to do something.
Right,
we're going to have some sort of action. And I have always believed that there was, in my sense, too fast a stop to the street action. I would have liked to have seen that arc continue. Instead, there was a hard break, and then you went toward electoral. I think a little of both. I think you blend these things. But I'm not in the camp that says, for instance, that going to an electoral strategy was completely wrong. The fact of the matter, I think it's important to point out that the way national media covered the Wisconsin struggle was, oh, they tried to recall Scott Walker, they didn't succeed. Forget it. The reality under the radar is it created an incredible movement that exists to this day. In small towns in Wisconsin, you can get hundreds of people out for trade union, public sector, public education fights. That's very important, too, and this is the other part of it. Those recall elections were not just the governor. They were for state Senate seats. Control of the state Senate was flipped for the better part of the last year, or for the better part of 2012. And the impact of that and the threat of that, I would venture to say, is one of the real reasons why Michigan did a right-to-work law, but Wisconsin did not. Mm. Indiana did a right-to-work law. Wisconsin did not. And so I think we do this with the anti-war movement as well. We do this with so many things. We say, well, you didn't succeed because you didn't stop the war in Iraq. But it's hard to measure whether we stopped the war with Iran. It's hard to measure
right. What
else. And so what I would say in Wisconsin, the best way to understand it is that people did exactly what they should have done. They took on an assault on labor rights. They did the best they could. They made mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. But at the end of the day, they built a movement that extends to this day. They, I would argue, unquestionably stopped some bad things. And intriguingly enough, they caused some Republicans to break with their own party. And there's a great senator in Wisconsin, moderate Republican Senator Dale Schultz, who was very conservative. He was the leader of the Republicans in the state Senate 10 years ago. And he voted in favor of voting rights, not against voter ID. He voted against assaults on the environment, broke with his party. You know what I mean? And I know Dale pretty well. I think he might have done the right thing on a few issues. He did the right thing on a whole bunch of issues. And I think there's simply no question it was because there was a real movement and some other legislators the same way. So, you know, I hate to inform people that organizing and activism doesn't always yield immediate results.
Right.
But it's true. I think it's really vital to do it.
I think that's fair. I mean, it's obviously much easier to look back.
Oh, it is.
But it was an abrupt shift on some level.
And I think maybe some stuff may have been left on the table. Even people who did it, I think, in hindsight. But remember, this was also, and not to belabor it, because the minutiae is not necessary, but to say that it was an intense time, that there were court fights, legislative fights, structural battles. People at the time they made that shift did not know that the Secretary of State, who was a Democrat, a guy named Doug LaFollette, who's running for re-election this year, was going to hold up implementation of the bill and not file it because of questions about stuff, which created weeks of opening that people didn't know
would have existed.
And so we look back in hindsight, we say, wow, you know, now that you know that, maybe a couple other things.
Right.
But my bottom line is I go all over this country and I go to all kinds of places. I still have people asking about Wisconsin all the time. When I talk to Occupy activists, when I talk to activists in other states, what they say is, boy, we saw those people in that Capitol and we thought maybe we could do some of this too.
Definitely.
And so if we fall into the trap of only measuring our victories and our successes by the rights propaganda, by its spin, boy, we're failures all the time.
Right. No, of course.
On the other hand,
I've spoken to some of the Water Brigade in Detroit. Many of them came out of the Occupy movement. And so the organization that they built at that time and the networks and the relationships, you know, carry on. I think that also
we talk about it. I listened to Elizabeth Warren at Networks Nation, her speech. I can tell you right now, that speech would not have been delivered 5 years ago. Even by Elizabeth Warren.
Right.
She got up there and she said, kid gets busted for pot, goes to jail, bank launders drug money, makes a fortune, doesn't get held to account, the system is rigged. That is, I think that there are Democratic politicians who might have believed that 10 years ago. I think there's very, very few that would have said that.
Right.
And then have the entire crowd rise up and applaud.
Right.
And all I'm saying is I believe that in the last 5 years, the language of our politics has shifted a great deal. And just as people on the right are much bolder in some of their language, I think people on the left and even mainstream Democrats are far bolder in their language than they were. And if grassroots citizens and activists hadn't occupied capitals, marched, rallied, taken on fights that they did not always win, And this is in Maine, this is in Pennsylvania, this is in states across this country. I don't think we'd be where we're at today as regards the language of our movements. And language isn't everything, but it's pretty important.
Well,
if we can't tell people
before,
what we're for.
It's going to always precede action. It's just a question of whether or not that action will end up coming. But, you know,
we are
trying.
On radio
indeed.
Right now.
John Nichols, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
It's a total pleasure, Sam.
Say to Napu Pay.